We bring you an interview with James Mark Leas, part of the National Lawyers Guild delegation to Gaza.
The Gaza Strip is a very small area. Nobody was allowed out. It wasn't like you had anywhere you knew to go that would be safe. And even people who we talked to who felt they lived in safe area because it was totally residential and there was no military activity and no military target suffered losses. One of them who felt that he lived in a safe place and didn't have to worry, his brother was shot by a drone from one of the drone vehicles. His little brother was 12 years old playing on the roof. In fact, he was playing with another kid and both of them were killed. The drone vehicle, as a TV camera, it's remotely controlled by someone sitting somewhere at a desk who can watch and control the gun on the drone. There was no reason why they would think these two children playing on a rooftop were anything but children, and yet they fired this weapon. The Al-Sharab story was actually one that had a Vermont connection because Mohammed, the father, had three sons. Two of them were with him while they were driving back from the farm, but the third was in Vermont. And we interviewed the father at his home in the south of Gaza. They were driving home, and the Israelis, without warning, shot at the car, forcing everybody to duck. The car hit a wall. We went to the location where this shooting took place and saw where the Israelis were shooting from across the road. The dad was hit in the arm, and the soldiers ordered everyone to get out of the car. When the oldest son did get out of the car, he was shot seven times in the chest and killed. The younger boy, when he got out, was shot in the leg. He was somewhat behind the car, so he didn't get killed, but he was allowed to lie there and bleed to death. And during the whole course of the 10 or 12 hours.
I think it was actually 20 hours, if I'm not mistaken, that the father was prevented from getting any help, that any contact or any medical aid or any of that, or ambulances were allowed. That's right.
The hospital, it turns out, was very close to
less than a mile away.
Within a mile away. You know, under international law, the wounded are protected people, and under customary law in the Fourth Hague Convention, the military forces on all sides are supposed to protect civilians and also wounded. Whether they're civilians or military, they're supposed to be protected. In this case, there was civilians. It was clearly civilians. There was no military objective. There was no reason for the Israeli soldiers to have shot them in the first place. But having done so, they had an obligation to either treat them themselves, which they could have done, or to allow the medical personnel to come in, and they didn't do that. No one got treated for many, many hours, and the son who had survived and certainly didn't have a wound that was necessarily life-threatening was allowed to bleed until he died. So,
yes.
I mean, why would soldiers be doing such a thing? Well, it turned out that the father reported to us that one of the farm workers on his farm, one of the three people who worked on the farm, was held in a house nearby. And that particular worker understood Hebrew and so overheard the commander telling the soldiers who had done the shooting that they should go ahead. And this was a decision. This wasn't just a mistake by these soldiers.
Well, let me just address that.
It was a command decision.
Jimmy, just to say this. You have 2 million pounds of bombs dropped. You have a sea of rubble, and this is hardly unique to this particular onslaught on Gaza. Every single predation of the Israeli armed forces against Palestinian camps in Palestine, in the West Bank, within the Green Line, within Gaza, within Lebanon, have this feature. In 82, for example, the Palestinian camps were leveled. 10 days and 10 nights of nonstop air assault, then followed by 10 days of artillery and shelling from the mountains and the sea. And then the bulldozers brought in, and they leveled everything. I'm talking about Ain el Helwey, then the largest camp in Lebanon. They ran these bulldozers over the shelters where people were trying to hide from the air assault and the artillery assault, burying people alive, the family members clinging to the bulldozers. This was characteristic of what occurred in Ain el Helwey, in Mia Mia, in Al Bas, in Burj al Jamali, in Rashidiya, in Burj al Barajni, in Sabra and Shatila, throughout Lebanon. This is again in Gaza replicating this pattern. It's not a matter, I think it's fair to say, of simply having soldiers on the ground targeting civilians. It's an entire policy of devastating the entire infrastructure. You look at the pictures of Ain el Helwey, of Rashidiya, of any of the camps in Lebanon from 82, and you look at the pictures of Gaza, and you see exactly the same thing. A sea of rubble, the collapse of the homes and the structures, the mosques and the schools and the hospitals and all of the infrastructure of the society, just a sea of rubble and destruction. Who lives there? Nothing but civilians, nothing but the population. What's the target?
It's the civilians. We came to the same, to the conclusion, we didn't have whole, well, we did have whole neighborhoods demolished. What we found from talking to people in very different neighborhoods was very similar description, that civilians were moved into one location. Maybe it was the woman's house we were talking to. Then tank shells were fired at the house, and people inside the house were killed. And then people were injured. And then as people were leaving the house, they were targeted with bullets. There was no resistance going on during any of this. We had a situation where the soldiers came to a house, ordered everybody out of the house, from that house and from neighboring houses, separated the men from the women, and then in one case, while a woman who lived in Khan Yunis, which is in the south of Gaza, came out of her house, she took an extra precaution. She had some white scarf, and she cut it up to make white flags for the women who walked out with her, and then the Israelis shot directly at her head and killed her. Story after story of different soldiers being involved in attacks on the civilian population in groups and as individuals. We had a situation where a man in a neighborhood was forced out of his house with his wife, his mother, his three daughters, and then after standing with the Israeli soldiers for a period of time, something like 5 to 7 minutes, one of the soldiers shot and killed two of his very young daughters, ages 2 and 7, severely injured a third, age 4. Why would there be so many of these incidents?
They're not random. There's a pattern.
Yeah, and we concluded that this was not just a matter of disproportionate use of force or collateral damage. We were finding cases where civilians were specifically targeted, that the violence was being directed against the civilian population. We saw that this is consistent with the numbers that have been reported. 400 children were among those killed.
And 20,000 homes and 93 mosques and schools.
There was a huge amount of destruction. We saw hundreds and hundreds of apartment buildings and individual residences completely, completely demolished. We also saw schools that were demolished. One of the schools is this American International School that we visited and met with the director and stood outside the school and looked at the total devastation of the school. It's separated, widely separated from other structures. There are two or three houses neighboring, but other than that, it's kind of in an open area, and it was hit by very substantial amount. I mean, it was a big school. It had 300 or 400 students. It was, you know, a concrete structure. It was only 6 years old. It had been built with the idea of being modeled on the American school system by the director who'd spent 20 years in the American school system. Why would they target this? Certainly the Israelis knew the coordinates of the school, were familiar with its location. It was very well known. And in the middle of the night, it was destroyed. The same was true for UN schools. Five of them were hit by Israeli forces, killing people. Some of those schools were hit during the school day, and in one case, over 40 children were killed.
We have to put this into context as well. Of a longstanding state of siege, in which the population is literally being starved out. They're bombing the tunnels now, and the tunnels are carrying what? Carrying the means of sustaining electric power, the means of sustaining hospitals and bringing in food and medical supplies. The weapons are random homemade weapons, these rockets. They don't depend on tunnels for weapons. They're not being sent in from the outside. That aside, if one really looks at what we have here, it is the attempt to destroy entirely the social economic infrastructure of an entire society and population. This is a genocide that we see.
What we concluded was that when you look at the attacks on individuals and groups of civilians, the military attacks, then as you say, the attacks on humanitarian aid, food and medicine and the other necessities, fuel and so on, coming in through the tunnels, but also through the borders where Israel has very severely restricted the flow of trucks entering Gaza. We heard from the UN, the director of the United Nations Relief Works Agency, that since the war, the number of trucks entering is fewer than before the war. And even though the need is much, much greater because of the destruction and because of the injuries, they're getting only about an average of 100 trucks, whereas before they were getting at least 120 trucks. The need is 500 or 600 trucks a day, or that was the need, and that was what was being brought in several years ago. But since the war and the devastation, they need thousands per day, he said, to make up for and to rebuild, to have the materials. So they're blocking food aid and medical aid from coming in at the borders. Palestinians have resorted to digging tunnels under the borders with Egypt. Those are being bombed. We also found that during the war, the Israeli bulldozers and tanks came in and destroyed farmland that was producing crops. This time of year, you can get crops.
Yes, the entire agricultural sector was targeted for devastation.
The agricultural sector was targeted. The buildings, the farm equipment, and the land was plowed up. 60% of Gaza's agricultural. Now, I don't know what military target could be found in agricultural land where food is being grown. It just doesn't seem that there could be any possible military objective with destroying farmland.
When one considers that you have a population here without an army, without an air force, you don't have a uniformed army, you have a population under siege being starved out with random assassinations, and you have a political organization that tries to defend its population and to resist. That's an army. This whole category is, it's like describing the Nazi onslaught on the Warsaw Ghetto. The Jewish resistance in the Warsaw Ghetto is an army comparable to the Wehrmacht? That's the analogy.
We also found evidence that they militarily attacked those who had humanitarian aid. The UN facility itself was bombed, and was bombed with white phosphorus. I have a picture of the residue of the white phosphorus that burned out the warehouse, destroying many, many tons of food and medical supplies. We saw the blackened bottles, medicine bottles, piled up in this warehouse. We have blocking food delivery, we have destruction of agricultural land, we have destruction of food and medicine in warehouses, we have attacks on civilian population.
Jimmy,
the whole
thing adds up
to not so much a war against of military against military, but an attack. I wouldn't call it a war. I'd call it just an attack on the civilian population of Gaza.
Jimmy, in that connection, I know your report references this. You've just mentioned white phosphorus, which is, as we know, is a fiendish chemical. Once hitting persons, continues to burn, and water only causes it to destroy more rapidly, burning into the flesh and bone. But it gives off a gas.
You know, one thing we learned about white phosphorus was that it's actually not just something that burns. It has two kinds of burn. I would put it that way. It's not just a thermal burn. It's also a chemical burn.
Yes.
That's happening. So the injuries, the doctors we spoke to at Shifa Hospital said that what they were finding was that even if they treated the thermal burn, if they didn't get all the material out of the wound, which they didn't at first, until they understood how to treat it, the patient would come back a week later or a few days later with a much more severe burn from the phosphoric acid or whatever the chemical is.
At Shifa, did you discuss or have the opportunity to speak to the doctors and attendants and physicians there about the particular character of the wounds with these weapons involving tungsten and metal additives that destroy the internal organs, blacken them? There's a huge amount of reporting over the years in Gaza of the use of very specific biological and chemical agents that have almost unparalleled impact on the internal organs of the victims. The dime requires amputation in 25% and 30% of all cases, but that aside, that the organs are charred and burned and almost coalesced into an indistinguishable mass, that they are inoperable, this is a use of a particular kind of weaponry ubiquitously. Did this arise in Shifa or in your other meetings with the medical people?
Yes, it did. We talked to a doctor from South Africa who was here for a few weeks, and he reported that he'd seen this evidence of this dense inert metal explosive or dime weapon. And he said that it was the dime weapon that caused the amputations rather than the doctors amputating the injured.
Mm-hmm.
This is something that, you know, our team feels needs much more investigation. I did also speak to, I mentioned this earlier, about the boy who was on the rooftop, was killed by the drone. That weapon that killed him and his friend that he was playing with is suspected also to be this dense inert metal explosive. And he said that the residue from that has been taken out of Gaza and is being analyzed to see what it's made of. So I think there's certainly a further investigation of this and information that's going to be coming out.
We saw reports, I wanted to ask you about this, Jimmy, of three specific types of weaponry. One involving both depleted and non-depleted uranium, which would indicate a certain amount of radiation and a permanent contamination in the area. A second involving the use of a gossamer-like powder, a black gossamer-like powder that is indicative of a graphite bomb. These things were used ubiquitously by the United States in the first Gulf War and in Iraq. The gossamer graphite actually causes the electrical power lines to explode, and it destroys the entire power and electrical infrastructure of a society and turns them into virtual bombs themselves, these electrical...
Wow. No, yeah. We didn't hear anything about those.
And indeed, the depleted uranium was reported widely, I thought. Did you encounter reports of radiation as a consequence of this weaponry in Gaza?
I can't really say we have any evidence of depleted uranium from our delegation or any of the people we talked to,
mm-hmm.
although we can't exclude that it was used. I did hear, you know, people talk about it, but I don't think we have enough to really say that it was used here.
Mm-hmm.
We certainly did see evidence of white phosphorus, and we saw the white phosphorus residue ourselves. We know that we saw people who had severe burns from the white phosphorus as well. And by the way, the white phosphorus, as we talked about, causes an enormous amount of suffering. It was used in heavily populated areas, it all by itself. And it's used in a way where the shell, it causes civilian neighborhoods and facilities to burn and gets on the skin of people and causes a huge amount of suffering, which in and of itself is a war crime. Because, as I said before, the customary international law on the Fourth Convention of Hague from 1907 make such weapons illegal. It seems that Israel must feel some level of impunity, that they'll be able to do things and they won't have to be held accountable.
Well, they
for
are.
What they
are,
do.
They are. They're supplied the weapons by the U.S.
And this whole discussion that we're having of one act after another, which is outrageous and in violation of international law, I don't think if they think they're going to be held accountable, I think they would be restrained from doing these things. I think that there's the idea, and as you pointed out, they've been doing these kinds of attacks on civilians for a long time. So nobody's going to be holding them to account. They're not going to be brought to trial. But I think things have changed. The large number of people who came out in the streets all over the world and are demanding accountability. And when you speak to the UN director of the UN Relief Organization here, John Ging, it seems that there's a real awareness that if something isn't done to hold the Israeli officials and military personnel responsible, this is going to happen again. And it's going to happen. Maybe this was just a test case. Maybe this was just a warm-up or practice for what they're going to do in the future if
in the near
they're not
future.
Held accountable. And I think one of the things that this delegation came away with was the idea that action is needed on various forums around the world to hold the Israeli officials accountable and to make sure that they know that if they do anything like this again, they'll be held accountable again.
And I think we might mention that the weaponry was supplied by the United States, that the military operations were coordinated with American support and presence and foreknowledge, that Israel is not merely acting on its own, but as an instrument of U.S. imperial policy in the region.
That's right. The U.S. was a partner in this attack. The weapons that we saw, the weapons, the shell casings, the various physical things that you could look at from the exploded bombs, the shrapnel, some of it had markings that we could read. And it looks like the weapons were supplied by the United States. Now, there's supposed to be limitations. There are limitations in U.S. law, in the Foreign Assistance Act and then the U.S. Arms Export Control Act, that prohibit the use of these weapons on the civilian population. And the question is, will the current U.S. administration observe the law, or will they continue to allow Israeli officials to act with impunity with U.S. weapons? I think people all around the world know that the U.S. supplies Israel with these weapons, and it isn't going to be hidden from anybody that the U.S. is a part of this attack that appears to be directed specifically at the civilian population. There's one thing that was not in our statement that we issued immediately as we were finishing our investigation.
The statement, which is called A Report from Gaza, Strong Indications of Israeli War Crimes, by the National Lawyers Guild.
That's correct. That statement really focuses on things that we saw ourselves in Gaza or were reported to us by people who were witnesses themselves. But the whole character of that, the collection of facts, the facts in their totality, make a strong case that this was a war directed against the civilian population, as we talked about, with weapons that were used against civilians, with weapons that caused an enormous amount of suffering, with targeting humanitarian supplies into Gaza, with targeting agricultural land, with targeting medical personnel. The whole thing adds up to something larger than any one of them individually, that this seems to be a war directed against the civilian population, which is itself a very serious war crime. So then, to me, it raises the question, what about the initiation of this war? Was this really a war in self-defense? If you are going after the civilian population, maybe you weren't just targeting somebody who was attacking you and you were acting in self-defense. And, you know, Israel's got many, many prominent people all around the world, especially in the United States, actually, to say that Israel has a right to defend itself, and that even Congress passed by a lopsided vote a bill or a resolution supporting Israel action. President Clinton, former President Clinton, and at the time President Bush, also came out and said Israel has a right to defend itself. Former New York City Mayor Koch came out with an opinion piece that was entitled Israel has a right to defend itself. There was a whole campaign was underway that Israel had a right to defend itself. And so, but the facts that were omitted from many of these statements actually show that Israel was not defending itself, and that Israel had already succeeded in ending rocket fire on Israel long before December 27th, when it invaded Gaza. In fact, in June of 2008, Israel and Hamas, through Egyptian mediation, had reached a ceasefire agreement under which Israel acknowledges. Israeli spokesperson Mark Regev told the BBC, it's on YouTube, anybody can watch it, he agreed that Hamas rocket fire had ended.
But more than that, the predicate of the ceasefire was that the Israelis would stop the starving out and deliberate siege of Gaza, and furthermore, that the Israelis would not continue their program of assassination of any militant, any youngster, any person who had any political expression of support for his own population. They never did either. They continued after the predicate of the truce was the cessation of the blockade and the targeted assassinations. They escalated both. Meanwhile, not a single Israeli had been killed by a rocket of the youngsters in Hamas. When they began the attack, not one Israeli had died. Not one.
That's right. So we have the Israeli spokesman, the official Israeli spokesman, Mark Regev, telling the BBC that Hamas hadn't fired any rockets during the entire time of the ceasefire up until the day that Israel attacked Gaza on November 4th and killed six Hamas members. This attack just has been sort of buried in the American media. It was reported, but it really didn't get the prominence that it deserved. It appears that there's something significant about the date here. November 4th was also the date of the U.S. presidential election. And it seems that Israel selected this date to initiate the armed attack and kill the six Hamas members on a day when it wouldn't be prominently reported.
Just as they ceased the attack on the eve of the inauguration of Barack Obama, that they could cease the attack before he had to take formal responsibility, although he took de facto responsibility from the inception for this.
Right. And that's also worth discussing. So we have this attack on November 4th, after which there's a barrage of rockets from Hamas. And so we go back to a period where Israel is now getting rocket fire, got rocket fire from November 4th through the rest of November and in December as well. And so Israel then claims that it's defending itself. In ordinary criminal law, you can raise the argument of self-defense if you're attacked and you're defending yourself, but it requires that you show that the other person attacked and you didn't initiate the attack. If you initiated the attack, the other person defends themselves and retaliates against you, you cannot use the argument of self-defense. It has to be based on you're actually defending yourself from the other person, not defending from their retaliation for your initiating the attack. And that's exactly what happened here. Israel initiated the attack on Gaza, and actually it was a lethal attack. It killed six Hamas members on November 4th. And that fact is consistently omitted by everyone from President Bush, former President Carter, former Mayor Koch, everybody who comes and says that Israel has a right to defend themselves, omits mentioning the attack initiated by Israel on November 4th that ended the ceasefire. Now, once the ceasefire ended because of Israel's attack, I don't think you can justify saying that Israel is defending itself. Another thing that's worth mentioning is that Israel has already agreed that if it is attacked by anybody, that it would bring the matter to the UN Security Council, and this is something Israel didn't do. It had plenty of time to do so. If it felt that its November 4th attack was somehow a way of defending itself from Hamas, these six Hamas members who were doing something that Israel thought was threatening, then it had plenty of time between November 4th and December 27th to do what it had already agreed to do when it signed on to the UN Charter and became a member of the United Nations, that is, bring the matter to the Security Council and let the Security Council take action. Instead, Israel took unilateral action in violation of that agreement. I think we have something that is not really something that we as a delegation investigated while in Gaza, but the facts about this are certainly worth investigating and reporting on, about how this war started and whether Israel was in fact acting in self-defense. And it looks to me like the evidence shows that this was a war of choice, that this was a war that Israel initiated, that it was in no way defending itself. It already had stopped rocket attacks by reaching an agreement with Hamas, and that it violated that agreement by killing Hamas members and starting up the back and forth with Hamas, where Hamas was now again shooting rockets.
Homemade rockets randomly striking with compared to the F-16s and F-21s and missile armory and of the fourth greatest military power in the world, to call these random rockets of a besieged population in any sense an equivalent of what the Israeli behemoth inflicts upon the population is an insult to one's intelligence.
Right. You're hitting on something that has been raised in the media, actually, and that is proportionality. Whether the response of Israel was proportional or, I don't know, it's not used in the mathematical sense, proportionality. It's really what they're trying to say is it on a roughly equal level to the violence that was used on that they claim was used on Israel. So if Hamas is using rockets that carry a payload of pound or a few pounds of explosives, then is it correct for Israel to drop a million pounds of explosives on Gaza?
But I would like to suggest this to you as well, Jimmy. Even a pacifist understands the moral distinction between the violence of the victim and the violence of the perpetrator. The Warsaw Ghetto Uprising entailed violence. The resistance in Yugoslavia, in Norway, in Denmark, in France, entailed violence. Does one make an equation between the violence of the resistance to the Nazi occupation and the onslaught of the Wehrmacht and the Waffen-SS? Since when has this absurd equation been made between the violence of the victim and the violence of the aggressor, the question of scale?
No, I think that's also... That's a really important point as well. The Israelis are the occupying entity here. They are controlling the access to Gaza. They demonstrated their occupation when they block humanitarian supplies into entrances to Gaza from land and also from sea, where they have stopped now several ships that were attempting to bring humanitarian aid into Gaza. And it's absolutely legitimate for people living under military occupation and suffering from tyranny to resist. and it is totally inappropriate for the occupying nation to use any violence and to do anything except withdraw and leave them alone.
This has been Taking Aim with
Ralph Shoneman
and Maya Shoneman. Visit www.takingaimradio.com. And please look at all our programs in our program archive and contact us at takingaim@pacbell.net.
Tikki tikki no bini ai, tikki tikki no bini ai, ta tam ta chim.